Okay, guten Morgen zusammen. Dieser Track wird komplett auf Englisch sein, deswegen schalten wir gleich auf Englisch um. Good morning, everybody. Welcome to this grid and clustering and, a virtualization track, very important virtualization on this Linux Tag. This track was organized in conjunction with three moderators. I'm just one of them. The others are not here yet, but they will show up eventually. We will have Chris Beutert from Extend to be Extend, and Florian von Samson from BSI, and I'm Markus Hart from Forschungszentrum Karlsruhe. We have set together to select this, to invite these people for this Linux Tag. And the program today will start with Rüdiger Berlich, also from Forschungszentrum Karlsruhe, who has jumped in for Ulrich Drepper, who is from Red Hat, who canceled his talk. So now we have a much more interesting talk even from Rüdiger Berlich about the root and proof toolkit. It's an open source, open source toolkit for C++ scripting and data analysis. And proof is the parallel root facility, which Rüdiger will talk about in further detail. Right after that, we have Werner Fischer, who will talk about the high availability clustering of virtual machines and possible pitfalls. We'll continue with Hubertus Franke from IBM, who will improve the memory management in hosted Linux systems. In the afternoon, the keynote talk will be about Zen 3 from Stephen Hand, who is a core developer of the Zen team, so this might be a very interesting talk. Right after that will be Volker Büge from the University of Karlsruhe, who will show how they use virtualization, Zen virtualization in the grid. Then Thorsten Antoni, one of my colleagues, will present the EGI project, Enabling Grids and eScience in Europe. This will show the grid infrastructure that we are building up currently in Europe. And finally, Klaus Roberts will present his software deployment to the grid for high energy physics. So we'll outline how they will run the software, the grid software, and how they will install it. So now we're glad to have Rüdiger Berlich here, who has a lot of experience with C++ and root coding. I'm happy he can join us today.
Thank you very much, Markus. Can everybody understand me here? Is the microphone working? I guess. Can you hear me in the back of the room there? Okay, thank you very much. So let me just switch to the presentation, actually. Markus, can I close this? Okay. Yeah. So maybe that's better. Now, okay, so this talk is about open source data analysis with root and proof, and this is, it's a software that has been developed in the context of high energy and particle physics, and this usually means that quite a few people are involved in creating this sort of stuff, which explains the abundance of logos on this slide here. So we won't say much about that later. What I want to say something about is just one slide where I come from. This is Forschungszentrum Karlsruhe, somewhere in the middle of the woods. Explanation is just that they used to do nuclear research. These days, they do a lot of other research topics, ranging from environmental studies over nanotechnologies all the way to grid computing. And this is Institute for Scientific Computing. There's my office, looking right onto some Zwischenlager for nuclear waste. Beautiful view in the summer because I don't see it because it's obscured by trees. Okay, so let's jump right in. If you do data analysis under Linux, then probably what you will come across is one of these programs. Very simple. Here you've got XMGraze with a nice function that's very difficult, where it's very difficult to find the minimum of, for example. This would be here, XMGraze, which allows plotting of data points with error margins and stuff. This is actually a measurement of access speeds of hard drives, and this is the buffer cache that you see here, the big drop here. And then for some more sophisticated data analysis, you would probably use something like MuPet under Linux, or Mathematica, or Maple, maybe. And of course, you can use spreadsheets, maybe, for data analysis. Now, just a short definition. It's just a definition that I found that was convenient for this talk because it fits everything I do here. Probably you'll find other definitions that fit your purpose. Now, according to this, data analysis is the process of systematically applying statistical and logical techniques to describe, summarize, and compare data, and that's something that which is very true in high-energy physics, where this tool comes from. And that's what the kind of data you would get in high-energy physics. This is a picture of an experiment, of a reconstructed collision of two particles, of a running experiment, of the Baba experiment. And you see, maybe not very well here, a few tracks, charge tracks. And this is an experiment that will start in 2007. And you see a huge amount of data being created there in the CMS detector, which needs to be stored and analyzed. And expectations are in the range of 10 to 40 petabytes for all experiments of the Large Hadron Collider per year. A petabyte is 10 to the power of 15 bytes, so that's a huge amount of data. Transferring that over one gigabit link would take you about 100 days. Fortunately, all this data is trivial to analyze in parallel because you can cut up the data set in little chunks and analyze all the sub data sets on different machines, right? So that makes it quite easy. You've actually got a huge amount of files there. In the case of the Ellis experiment, 10 to the power of 9 files. Try using that in the average Linux file system and do an ls in the directory. Good luck. Okay. And you not only have a lot of data, but you also have a huge analysis task there for the to find the right signature in the data, because this is what you start from, and this is what you're looking for the Higgs boson. If you find this, well, you've got the Nobel Prize, or maybe the speaker of your collaboration has. So this is equivalent to looking for a needle in 20 million haystacks. So you can imagine that there are huge analysis tasks out there, right? And that's something you cannot do with something like gnuplot. You need something much more sophisticated. So what does a typical analysis job in particle physics look like? You take raw data coming from the detector, you perform analysis tasks common to every analysis. This means the reconstruction of raw data. And this involves reconstruction of tracks, trajectories, energies, momenta, and stuff, and finding vertices where a particle has decayed into other particles. A lot of reconstruction power is needed there. And then you've got worldwide about 6,000 physicists in the Large Hadron Collider who want to access all this data. Everyone wants to run over it a lot of times, apply cuts to parameters, create histograms of particle masses and stuff. So you start with an experiment, with a measurement of data from which you create events, and you combine these, and from that you get such a plot, which is a histogram. In this case, with a D plus decaying in a phi and a pi plus, a DS plus. And you already see here that in order to create this sort of histogram, maybe gnuplot is not the best choice, or xmgrace for that matter, because, well, you need something that gives you Greek characters, or any character you like. You need rather sophisticated annotations, draw in that plot, and so on. Plus, you also need to do a lot of Monte Carlo simulation, which means you create artificial particles to compare them with the measured particles. So what's a histogram? This is a histogram that you see here. It's basically you count the amount of certain events that fall into a certain bin. In this case, it's Gaussian, and you can implement this within, in this case, 39 lines of code. I've done it here, right? So you could, just to show you that this is compilable code, because we'll use that, that code snippet a little bit later, you could use, compile this, run test.cc, so I'll switch back and forth between some public demonstration and the slides, right? So there you go, it's compilable code. Maybe you trust me now, right? Bad mistake. Okay. And we go on. Actually, well, the core of this histogram implementation are these last 6-7 lines or something. It's really quite easy what a histogram is, but you need more, right? Because what you want for an average analysis is something that looks like this, a very complicated plot. Not just some ASCII graphics, but you want very sophisticated graphics with embedded graphics here, error margins, you want to fit functions to the data, so there's much more to this than just plotting. And again, the Greek characters here. Okay, so if you want to do analysis for experiments that create 40 petabytes every year, then, well, there are a few requirements that you need to fulfill. Obviously, the environment you're using needs to be efficient and scalable. We are dealing with billions, really billions of events here, most of which you can throw away, but you, the bad thing is you don't know which events you have to throw away, so you have to run through all of them. It really needs to be easy, extensible, and customizable, and needs to be it needs to be able to be integrated into other environments, because no experiment is like the other, right? So you need to customize your analysis environment. It needs to be scripted, maybe. You want to do distributed and parallel computation, because some of the tasks we're doing here are too large for one machine. Reason being that in a scripted environment you have no compile cycle, so that's very convenient because you save a lot of time. Well, okay, we want a familiar environment, very much so, because we're human, we don't like to change. Okay, and people using this are physicists, so maybe others don't like our environment, but so customization is again maybe something other people that want to use this environment might want. And then, of course, we don't want to have much hassle to save the plots we've just generated for a publication. So we want to be able to save them in different formats. We want to annotate the plots and actually do a lot of design work. Plus, these tools that we've developed should not only be usable in particle physics, but outside this environment. So they have to be general enough for basically everybody in industry and science, and for the average layman to use on a daily basis, should he or she want so. So a first approach to do this, and that was not yet parallelized, was PAW, which is still available. That's the URL here. Still a bit clumsy that you see here. One might argue that this is because this was centered around a Fortran interpreter, not a compiler, and was using a very a funny scripting language, which arguably had a lot of bugs, or maybe it was where my programming skills, but it did a lot of bad things to me, with a graphical interface where you were not allowed in one version to move the mouse over certain areas of the interface, so because it would crash, which is bad, I guess. Maybe it's a feature, not a bug, but don't know. It's freely available, runs everywhere, on including Linux, but it's quite outdated because meanwhile there's root, which we will talk most of the rest of the time about. Now, root is based around something called CIN, which is a C++ interpreter. Not a compiler, but an interpreter. And this is something I have actually, I'm not aware of many other C++ interpreters. There are a few C interpreters out there, but I'm not aware of at least a free C++ interpreter. It's not entirely ANSI compliant. It's about 95% ANSI C compliant and 85% C++ compliant. This does not sound much. However, if you work with this, you never really notice a difference. And it's actually capable of interpreting its own source code and let the interpreted interpreter interpret a small program without crashing. And this, I think, is quite a quite an achievement. Plus, it can call compiled code, right? Either you can load dynamic libraries from it, or you can link it with other libraries. It can also do on-the-fly compilation of the scripts that you provided with, provided you don't use too much freedom of and use the extensions that CINT uses. It has some extensions like runtime type identification. If you use that, well, GCC will say no, maybe not. Compiled code can call CINT, can call scripted functions, actually. So you can use CINT as an extension language. You can use C++ scripts to extend your programs, maybe even your Fortran programs. I haven't tried that, though. Right. Dynamic loading of shared objects, source files. There's a debugging interface in there. Imagine the kind of development environment you could create with this. I think that would be amazing. It's ultra-portable. I won't go through all the different operating systems out there, but it's basically available for every major operating system on the planet. And what I want to show you now, again, as a public demonstration, is first runtest.cc. Just let's have a short look into this. This includes a number of libraries. This is 39 lines of code, as I said, but it includes native libraries. For example, the Mersenne Twister library, which is a random number library of C++ classes, and rather sophisticated one. Standard template library vector classes are not really easy either, and IOStream is there as well. So while this has only 39 lines of code, it's actually not an easy example, right? The logic of this program is easy to understand, but it's not an easy example. So I hope this doesn't bail out on me. We'll see. So it does. I can blame this on SUSE 10.1 beta 9. Maybe anybody from SUSE here in the room? No? Okay, so I can blame it on that one. But anyway, you see here that it has done what it should, right? It has created the histogram here. Okay. So no, I'm not hiding anything. You get the dump here. Now, ROOT, which stands for, it's actually an acronym pretty much like GNU, because it stands for ROOT Object Oriented Toolkit. So it's recursive, right? It extends CINT by linking a number of libraries with it. Its main purpose is to provide tools for data analysis and display, but it can do a lot more. You can, for example, use the MESA libraries from ROOT, because you can link them with ROOT. So you can have an OpenGL interpreter if you want. You can pretty much link every other library on the planet that you want with it. Now, extends it with its own binary libraries. Most of them have to do with analysis and plotting, and this is done with C++ scripts. We'll have a look into this. It's actually, I think, one of the largest open source projects out there, because it has the size of the 1.3 kernel series. So it's nevertheless, I think, pretty much unknown outside of the particle physics community. which is something I'd like to change, and because it's under the LGPL, so please feel free to work with it and change it if you want. It's open source. Right. It arguably has unlimited features, because if there's a feature that you don't like, well, you can implement it quite easily without changing the code of root or cint, because all you have to do is implement your own libraries. It can do distributed analysis using proof, which we'll hopefully demonstrate below a little bit. So I'd call it the Ferrari of analysis tools. It's, I think, another league than GNUplot or even MuPet, I think. So let's do a few demonstrations here. Let's start root. I'll show you the nifty, nice splash screen here. And the first thing I'll show you is, standard first search functions there, because I've obviously tried the functions I'm showing you now here before. I'm just typing control R like in a bash. And I get here the TF1. I'm declaring an object here of the TF1 type, right, which is a histogram. It's a function plotter. So I plot here the function sinus x divided by x in the range 0 to 10. Actually, I'm not plotting it. I'm just creating the object at that point. And now I can do something like this. F1.draw, just standard C++ syntax. And there we go. Right? Now, maybe I don't like the color here. That's actually not it. So I can change a lot of parameters here. I'm not sure here. That's the border. Whatever. Okay, I can change basically everything in this plot. And then, if I've created this from a C++ script and I've made changes, I can actually save this as C++ code, right? As a C++ script. So a common way of designing your histograms or plots would be to start with a script which does roughly what you want, and then you start modifying it, save it again, and until you really have what you want, because you want very sophisticated plots. You could compare this a little bit with LaTeX, right? Because in LaTeX, this is not really a VisiVig environment. It's a scripted analysis environment. Let's just have a look here into the C1.c. I think the naming scheme is a bit odd. But anyway, this is what creates this plot that we just had. So we've showed function plotting. Let's do some more sophisticated plots. I'll load data here. I've attached a file, which is in a data format which is called trees, which could be compared to database records. So you can run analysis jobs over this data where you have in your scripts branches where you say, if the momentum of that particle is so and so high and the energy is lower than that and that, then please take this, right? So you can have very sophisticated choosing schemes. It's pretty much its own database implementation, you could say. I'll plot first. This is called a Delitzsch plot. This is a delta particle here. If you see these bends in a Delitzsch plot, then it means, if no one else has seen it before, that you found a nice new particle, unless you've made huge mistakes, which happens in particle physics occasionally, of course, but we don't tell. You see here these annotations here, I just want to have a look into this. So this is what creates this plot, right? And you see here how these Greek characters are created, and you can see that this is pretty much LaTeX syntax, pretty much, not entirely, right? But if you know LaTeX, you will very quickly know how to annotate these plots. And arguably, many people that would be users of this would actually know both LaTeX, maybe, and this environment. So I think it's a good choice. So you can draw lines here, for example, and no, I haven't guessed this value. I've moved these lines around until they were at a nice place that I liked. Or maybe it also came out of a minimization process in that case. I don't know, but I could change things here with a mouse if I wanted to. And have a look at the parameters of the new lines and put them here into the script, right? So very sophisticated, all pure C++, except that this is an unnamed script, so it doesn't have a name in this case. You could give it a name if you wanted to. So we can do, just for safe measure, have a look at the do a projection, maybe, that sort of thing. So we've projected now with another script the data onto one axis, and you can see here this nice peak which indicates another particle, and this is the division of Monte Carlo with data that's measured. So it's, well, fits so-so. Actually, not that bad. Now, before we continue, I'd just like to give you a little rundown of what this can actually do with root. Let me just see what the path is. Show you a little of a few of the options. Doc root tutorials. There we go. And we'll start the demos.c. So, okay, yes, there's a file browser that you can use to access your files, fine. So, dynamic updating, fine, you can do that, of course, in a scripted environment, or in a more sophisticated way. You can do nice functions here. Three-dimensional, actually, you can even do it four-dimensional, coded in colors, then. Okay, well, I think you get the idea, right? Let me just see here. So here can, that's probably done somehow with OpenGL, I don't know. Or maybe I've just scaled it. People have done albeit rather clumsy looking event displays with that. Okay, not sure what it does here. Right. Anyway, well, interpreter error. Well, that's good. SUSE 10.1 beta 9. No, it's my fault. All right. Hi, Richard. Okay, so you get the idea. It's a very sophisticated and widely usable environment. I might add that occasionally it crashes on me, but it does all I want, so I'm happy to live with that for a while. Now I want to give you an example of where I link some own code with root, because one of the libraries that's actually not included in root is the ncurses library. So, documents, talk, Wiesbaden. So I change here. I do a make clean, so you all believe that this is all new, right? I've done a make clean. So I first create, well, let's first have a look at the file. HelloWorld.c, right? This is a very simple ncurses program as an unnamed script in that case. Well, init function, and then at a certain position, 10, 10, I plot hello world. very simple program. Let me just show you that this actually does not work, right? It will emit an error because it doesn't know about init screen, the very first ncurses function. It'll bail out, right? So, first I create something called a dictionary file. This is the interface code for it, right? Right. Then I do a make. Now I've got my own root interpreter with ncurses in it. Let's just have a look at the make file because it's not easy actually to do this. It's not self-explanatory. So I think the biggest problem was to find out which libraries I needed to link in. And then there's another problem that actually cint or root does not understand entirely the syntax in the ncurses library, so you need to do some pre-processing with a preprocessor. There's a switch for that. Once you've done that, you can pretty much follow the standard syntax, but I'm giving you the complete picture. It's not all self-explanatory, but it's possible. Right. So now I've got my root executable, and I'll start that. And I'll execute the hello world.c, and there we go. Right, now it works. And, okay, I could have stayed in there. Start again my root, and what was it called? Histogram. No? Okay. .x histogram.c. This is now an ncurses implementation of a histogram, which is a bit more sophisticated. Right. So that's a Gaussian distribution plotted with ncurses and the root C in C and C++ interpreter, and it's just a hack, I admit it. Right. But have a lot of fun. Right. I'm a SUSE user, I have to say this. Right. Okay, so maybe now you believe me, I can actually link libraries with this interpreter and call the data from, or the functions in these libraries from my own scripts. Now, as next step, we want to embed cint and root into our own application. I will not go through all the details there. Actually, I will show you one slide about it. I will first show you projects, Eva. So examples, root individual. So what I've done here is I've done an evolutionary algorithm, and in the evolutionary algorithm you have so-called individuals where you rate the quality of these individuals with a certain function, and the algorithm itself stays pretty much the same, but the kind of the evaluation that you use for each individual is different depending on the data and the analysis tasks that you want to fulfill. So in this case, I want to search for the minimum of a parabola, quite an easy task. But I want to do it with an interpreted evaluation function. So I've got here the parabola.cc. Here you can see here result equals values times values. You can do this in many dimensions here. Actually, I had at one point plugged in something else here, so but that's commented out, right? So I'm giving doing the configuration here with some XML code which I've hacked for this. And just to show you that it works, root train parabola.xml, and then we wait because it's a slow laptop, and you've seen the root startup, and okay, you see it's where it would go with an evolutionary algorithm, not entirely to the minimum of this, but quite close. And evolutionary algorithm can jump very easily over local minima. Right. Documents, talks, Vspan, there we go. Okay, and well, embedding it is basically done in one call here, which looks a bit difficult. It's actually quite easy to understand. I won't go into the details, but it's documented. There's actually, well, somewhere there in my back, something like a 300-odd pages manual for the entire thing. So everything is maybe even over-documented. Right. Some of the limitations of Root. Okay, Root uses global variables, so if you want to embed the interpreter into a multi-threaded application, you'll be in trouble. If the interpreter is started in each thread. So that's, I think, for most applications, not a severe thing, but some will have a problem, like, for example, my evolutionary algorithms code. I'd love to embed the interpreter into a multi-threaded version of this. There's some C++ and C syntax missing, but it's really nothing you would ever notice in a standard C++ environment, so it's really not disturbing. The complexity is a problem because it can do pretty much everything under the world. So, like Emacs, it has a very steep learning curve, and the complexity really is a blessing and a curse, right? Because until you learn what it can do, it takes a while. Once you know what it can do a lot of jobs for you. Now, this tool is intended for the large and very ambitious tasks, not for very quick hacks. So maybe it's okay if it does a lot, because it has to. Currently, it's a standard application in particle physics. I think that's also maybe a problem, because I think it would be usable very much outside of that environment. To my knowledge, although I'm not too sure, I think it's also used somewhere by Telekom, Deutsche Telekom, but I'm not too sure. Right. Now, I've said, and I've stolen, you see this in the different coloring scheme, I've stolen this slide from someone else, from Kilian Schwarz of Gesellschaft für Schwerionenforschung in Darmstadt. It can also do parallel computation, because what I've shown you so far is something you would only do on a local machine, on your local environment, and I have so far not seen hard drives that would be able to store 40 petabytes of data every year, right? So maybe you want to analyze this data in a parallel environment with many, many jobs running in parallel on the grid, maybe, over all of your data. Also, because data transfer takes time, you could think about transferring the data that you're just analyzing to your local system and doing the analysis there, but with a few petabytes, that doesn't make sense, because your application is maybe just a few kilobytes or megabytes in size, so better bring the application to the data than vice versa. Right. PROOF stands for Parallel Root Facility, I believe. So quite simple, basically it distributes your scripts, a master distributes your scripts to slaves that have all access to the same file sets. If they don't, you're in trouble, but usually, at least in my environment, you've got replicas of the same data. So that's not really a problem. So it splits the data into chunks and assigns to each slave a certain subset. That's transparent for you. You won't notice. And then, in the end, it collects the results and returns them to you, to your home machine. So basically, you can use a few hundred or more CPUs out there from your own laptop, even, if you want. And I think that's quite convenient, because this is what the people in particle physics will want to do. Configuration in this case is a bit simple, I'd say. So you provide it with a master node here with some password and a port and slaves. But you need to know the target resources. This is actually quite well integrated also into the Alien middleware, which you might or might not have heard about. It's an open source grid middleware developed by the Alice experiment. So there, I haven't used it, so maybe I'm leaning a bit far out of the window, but I think you don't have to specify any target resources there. Right. So you would start, and that's actually the nice thing, you would start a proof daemon on each of these systems in user space. Right? You don't need root access on these machines, so you can actually submit these daemons as a job using a batch submission system in a cluster. And once they are started, off you go. So one of them becomes the master, and on the same machine there may also be further slaves, and then you've got further daemons running on the various nodes, and they become slaves, and your local PC talks only to the master. Right. Now, proof on the grid works very similarly. You could actually have daemons on many different sites, and then if this is the case, you would have a front-end daemon, basically, talking to your proof master server. So you would have submasters and master servers, and they talk to the master server. They say, hi, I'm there, so they can penetrate firewalls from the inside. So in most cases, actually, you can have a private address space there. Right. Okay. Now, let me see, and this is a bit the experimental part, whether I can manage to give you a little demonstration of this. Now, on my workstation at home in my office, I've started a daemon. Now, we are behind a firewall, so I do some port forwarding there, and I hope that the password won't show here, right? Okay. Hi, Marcus. He's our security expert. Right. Okay, I'm now logged in, and port forwarding with SSH means that I've now assigned the port 1235 of my office machine to port 112, sorry, vice versa. I've assigned port, it's this one, 1234 of my office machine to port 1235 on this laptop here. And on this laptop there's also a proof daemon running. Hopefully still. So let's have a look at the proof.conf. Oh, okay. That's on that machine. That's actually not what I want. So they see now. I'm giving my master node. There's one master node here, port 1234, and a slave node, which the system believes is, that's a little bit of a hack, believes is on my local laptop, on the local host on port 1235. And this is actually, if it talks to that, this is when it starts talking to my machine in the office, right? Right. So, let's just see. Well, this is just a very short demonstration, which I hope just works out of the box. Myproof.c. So it's starting the master, it's connecting, and there we go, it has done its analysis, and there's the Higgs boson. Right, this is where I get the Nobel Prize, and basically, my talk, maybe before I end it, let me just say that if I run two proof daemons on this machine here, one as master, one as slave, and don't use my office machine, in this case it's actually faster, because the analysis I've run here is very, very short. Right? So I would save 2 seconds by running everything locally, but if my analysis job takes an hour, then the time for going through SSH and encryption and everything won't count anymore. It doesn't matter, because these are sometimes called embarrassingly parallel tasks, where the different subtasks don't talk to each other, right? Okay, so I close that, which brings me to the part where I first thank the authors of Root and Synth, the organizers of Linux Talk, the audience, of course, German Federal Ministry of Education Research, GmbF, EGE, who actually pay part of my salary and of my being here. The other part is from Forschungszentrum. Thank you very much. And thanks to you all for listening. Bye.
Questions? So we have a few minutes for, well, a couple of minutes for questions and discussion. Maybe I start. Which license is it on?
Oh, it's LGPL. So okay. It's open source. It's freely available from root.cern.ch. Sometimes called a rootkit, but it's not a malicious rootkit. It's a very nice rootkit. So please feel free to use it and contribute your experiences back. People there will be happy. It's a very, very active user community. If you've got problems with it, you'll have an answer within an hour, usually, from the mailing lists. And it's very well documented. If you don't ask a question, I will. I'll pick someone from the audience. Maybe that's a nasty way. Maybe someone I know. Richard, do you have a question?
And another thing, how to contribute. I mean, where to get it and how to contribute, maybe.
Okay, you get it from root.cern.ch.
Because if you Google for root, I think you find lots of different things.
Yeah. Yes. Okay, give it a second. This is where you get it. Plus this beautiful logo. Okay, root.cern.ch, and you also get the C interpreter there if you want it separately. All the documentation is on there. Plus, I've used another beta version here, 5.11.02, so I can blame also the first crash in the very first few minutes on that. It's not SUSE; it's the beta version. Right, that's a question.
Wait, we put it on the internet, so you need to talk to the microphone.
I want to ask, what about the performance of the cint interpreter in comparison to Perl or Python? And why did you, why didn't you choose Perl or Python as an interpreter? Why cint?
First, let me say that there is a Ruby and a Python interface to the root functions, so you can use these for scripting. Secondly, cint does on-the-fly compilation if you ask it to. If you do this, and you do this just by, instead of saying .x myscript.c, you say .x myscript.c plus. And once you do this, it'll compile it behind the scenes. And the next time you call the script, it'll just load the shared library for you. It'll do linkage behind the scenes for you. And if you do this, you don't have any performance, very little performance penalty. You have some, but I wouldn't estimate it to be more than 10% or something.
Is it possible to use a root as a replacement of?
To use what?
As a replacement of application like MATLAB or Scilab or Octave? Or?
Well, it's not a fully fledged computational mathematics package. You can't do integration. I've not worked with MATLAB, so I wouldn't know, but you wouldn't be able to replace Mathematica or something with it. Mm. But it's for data analysis, plotting, that sort of thing. If you want symbolic integration, create a library and link it with an interpreter and use it. That's the beauty of it.
I think MATLAB is root is not as optimized for the mathematical routines, but more for the data handling. So if you need the performance, maybe MATLAB is better. But if you need a generic toolkit, root should be better. Yeah, sure. Yeah, more discussion.
I looked about the project on the internet and found in search for a reflection AP for C++ that there is part of this project some kind of reflection AP. Is that right?
To my knowledge, yes, but I haven't used it, so I think I can't comment. I shouldn't comment. But yeah, it's been mentioned.
Okay. So thank you again.
Thanks.